On this episode of Comedy Rewind, did the Farrelly brothers start a comedy trend with their Something About Mary? Is this the best character in the long career of Cameron Diaz? What's the more iconic scene, Frank and Beans or hair gel? All of this and more on Comedy Rewind.
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 Push rewind. I thought this was a comedy show.
What's going on, guys? Welcome to Comedy Rewind. We are powered by Audio Technica as we rewatch the great comedies of the 1990s. I'm your host, Jono Peck, and joining me today, they are Frank and Beans, Brendan White and Salim the Dream from The Hungry Gamers. How you doing?
How'd you get the beans above the Frank?
Just so good. Little bit of both, Brendan, you and I. Just a little bit of both.
That's it.
Who's the Frank? Who's the beans, Jono?
Well, Salim the Dream, seems you can be the beans. Just
Salim
rhymes,
the bean.
You know, it just works.
It works. All right.
Brendan's the Frank.
I'll take the Frank. That works for me.
It's great to have you guys both here together as part of the Hungry Gamers. Trying to get a bit of the chemistry that you bring to that show on this podcast. So thanks for coming on the show.
Extremely excited, and on the chemistry, we are like Walter White and Jesse Pinkman up in here, so we are gonna make some blue magic today discussing this Something About Mary. We cannot wait.
Speaking of chemistry, this movie is full of it. What an awesome, hilarious film. I watched it last night. I don't know about you guys, but I'm so glad we get to talk about There's Something About Mary.
I have to say, when you messaged me earlier and Brendan asking us to come on for this film, like my heart skipped a beat. This is one of the best films from my childhood. I rewatched it earlier today, actually, and it still holds up. I remember every joke, every gag, everything, and I still found myself laughing hysterically through the whole thing. I love this film so much. Where do we start, Jono? How do we get into this film right now? Let's talk.
I mean, I think we should maybe, as always, start with our experiences of it, which you just mentioned. You grew up watching this. You said as a child. I would have thought that maybe it wasn't suitable for children, but we're sensing a trend on this show that everyone else was allowed to watch like whatever movies they wanted as a kid. I had to wait till I was old enough, but you would have been like, what, 7 in 1998?
I would have been 7 turning 8 in 1998. And
I'm guessing
probably,
you watched it a few years later though, right?
Nah, of course not. Of course
probably
not.
Went to the cinemas.
I was in the cinemas.
Wag school in Parramatta and went and watched it.
I was already a Farrelly Brothers diehard by that point. This is obviously the age of the VHS and the DVD. And my memories of this film are watching it with my family, believe it or not, on the weekend. My father had this habit of always replaying the same films over and over again. He used to go to sleep watching movies. And if it wasn't a John Wayne film, it would be whatever the comedy flavor of the week was. And for so long though, it was Something About Mary. I distinctly remember watching it so many times, and then on this, say the 10th viewing, watching it with my dad, and in the scene where Ben Stiller Ted is just before his date with Mary, and it's the masturbation scene. My dad, on the 10th viewing, my dad's like, "Oh no, this is too heavy. You have to leave the room." I was like, and I didn't know what was going on at that point in my life. I just knew that this was funny for some reason, and that was like this weird birds and bees epiphany for me in my life. Like, that sticks out to me as one of my sexual epiphanies of like, there's something else here, something forbidden that I'm not sensing.
What about you, Brendan?
Similar to a degree. Like, I was a little bit older. Like, I was 12 when this came out, so I was sort of preteen, getting into that early adulthood stage. And by this time my mum and dad had separated, so mum and I had watched a lot of movies. She actually, one of the few jobs she worked at the time, she had sort of three jobs going. She worked at Video 2000, so we'd get access to movies and even sort of screeners sometimes that were sort of circulating around for the video clerks to watch before they come out. And I remember she brought home There's Something About Mary, because the Cooma Cinema, it didn't make it to Cooma Cinemas. It's single screen, even though it's called Cooma Twin Cinemas, still one screen, but anyway. But I remember sitting on the couch, we had the the like $1.99 popping microwave popcorn that we sort of nuked in the microwave, and we sat down, started watching this, and we've always had a good connection and a bond and a similar level of love for the same types of movies, and obviously Dumb and Dumb, which is something we talked about at length on a previous episode about this. My mum and I have got a similar sense of humor, and it translated really well with There's Something About Mary. And I remember just sitting on the couch, cracking my head up next to my mum, who was equally in hysterics. And similar situation, not the masturbation scene though, but like when there's a scene sort of in the final act, and Matt Dillon is sort of looking through the binoculars when Mary's getting changed. He's like, here comes the money shot. And he grabs the big giant binoculars, pans back up, and the elderly neighbor is there, and he sees her like giant, haggard, aged, tanned breasts. And he was like, hee! With his sort of moment of shock. And my mum sort of looked at me there like, shouldn't be watching this for a second, but then we just lost it. And like, it's just one of the fondest memories of my childhood, and especially with cinema. And yeah, it'll go down as a classic. Mm. What about you, Jono?
I don't remember the first time I watched it. I just remember it was probably similar, like the VHS DVD rental that me and my friends got and watched together, or maybe it was on a Saturday night or something. I don't exactly remember. I just know that it was, by that point, Ben Stiller was already a huge star by the time I saw it. So it was kind of just like another Ben Stiller movie. But, you know, having a bit of context now, it's kind of cool that this was, you know, his first starring role in a big film. And he'd been working for a really long time. He'd been writing and directing movies. He had his own TV show, but they took a big chance on giving him this role, which we'll get to as we get into the film a bit more. But yeah, it to me is right up there, I guess, with probably Zoolander and Dodgeball, as like, it's up there with the best of a good bunch of Ben Stiller movies, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Tropic Thunder is probably the only other one I'd probably put at that same level as those other ones you mentioned. But yeah, this is certainly the crown jewel.
Yeah, I think that one's a bit more of an ensemble.
Yeah.
Whereas he's definitely the lead in this film. And he really did such a great job with the character. There's a few things about this that stood out to me, and the first one is like how wholesome it is, despite being like this gross out humor that we'll talk about. The first, like, I don't know, 15, however long the flashback scene goes for, if it's 15 or 20 minutes, the prom leading up to that, it's all just like so wholesome. He's like this geeky guy who's really obviously polite and good mannered and got a heart of gold, which you see in the way that he interacts with Warren, which becomes a really crucial part of the film later. And then suddenly he's got his junk caught in a zipper, and it's like, okay, that's the kind of movie this is going to be.
It's fantastic. He even though, yeah, he was, I don't know, probably mid to late 30s when he was doing this flashback of the 16-year-old, but he's got, you know, the 80s sort of shoulder-length hair, the terrible suit, mouthful of braces, and it's just... Yeah, it tears on the heartstrings, doesn't it?
But there's no one in that first sequence when they're teenagers who is under the age of 25 when they're shooting that. Like, I think when I was a kid, I was like, this is what teenagers look like. And now as an adult, like approaching 30, I'm like, these guys are older than me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think even Cameron Diaz would have been 25 because she was 21 when The Mask came out. And that was only, well, it was released 4 years before this was released, so she would have been right around that age. And it's probably a good chance to talk about Cameron Diaz now. She's awesome in this movie. Like, this is probably her best role that I can think of.
Oh, you didn't like Charlie's Angels?
I did like Charlie's Angels at the time, but I think
you weren't a Full Throttle fan.
I think this one holds up a bit better than Charlie's Angels.
I think you're right. No, I agree. I think in this she's absolutely hilarious and
a great character too.
Yeah, but she does like really well in the role, and it's we'll unpack this all, I guess, as we go with the questions. But I think this whole film, it hasn't aged.
No.
Like, did you guys get that sense as well when you rewatch it? Like, there's not really much in there that you can really say doesn't fit 20 years later or 15 years later.
Yeah, we'll definitely get to that in the categories, but I guess. The last thing I want to say kind of just generally before we get into it is how much of a pioneer this film was for that gross out style of humor. The Farrelly brothers, obviously as the writers and directors, had coming off Dumb and Dumber in 1994, which was a huge success, and we've done a podcast on that episode too, as Brendan mentioned. And then I think they had a bit of a miss with Kingpin. They didn't know where their career was going, and they put this film together. And I think one of the reasons it holds up so well is because it was so influential in what was going to be the next style of film. We had a lot of kind of more family-friendly comedies leading up to this, where it was your Billy Madison, your Dumb and Dumbers, your Mrs. Doubtfires, whatever it might be. And then following There's Something About Mary was almost a new trend altogether, where it was, I think you can break it down into kind of three main categories for the 2000s, because this was 1998, and then obviously that's what followed. So we had all the teen movies like American Pie that came out the next year, and its sequels, movies like Road Trip, Euro Trip, and also, you know, taking that gross out style as far as they could go. Then you had all the Judd Apatow movies with Seth Rogen, Jonah Hill,
yeah,
Paul Rudd, Jason Segel. We're talking about movies like Forgetting Sarah Marshall, Superbad, and so on. And then you got the Will Ferrell, Owen Wilson, and other Ben Stiller movies, whether it was Zoolander, whether it was Wedding Crashers. I feel like those films were really huge in the 2000s, and they all kind of took cues from how successful this movie was and how it kind of balanced that tension between gross out humor, but like there's a bit of a heart of gold there at the end of the day, where you want these characters to succeed.
I'd absolutely agree, especially on the Apatow, divergent that goes on, because you can totally see it. And you've absolutely robbed me of a couple of golden points I was going to make later on. But I think the Apatows are the closest cousins to the Farrelly brother films. And when you look at this film and these films that the Farrelly brothers have put together, they seem to strike this weird balance of just being so funny, so irreverent, but also there's something really wholesome at the core of it. There's a really beautiful story at the core of it, between characters that you really grow fond of as you watch it, and also really learn to love and appreciate, and you can totally relate to. I'm going to save a couple of my other little nuggets for later, though. I won't fully unpack it yet, but I agree. I totally agree. I think this film and these films that these directors put together just set the tone for the next 10 to 15 years for sure.
Hmm. Anything on that, Brendan, before we move on?
I think you guys put it very eloquently, and I probably can't add much more on top. I'm just in agreement with yourselves. There's probably not going to be too much abrasiveness on this podcast. I think it's going to be three guys almost high-fiving each other around a campfire. So
I think so too. It's too good a film. No one poo-poos this. Okay. I can't think of anyone who poo-poos this film.
We'll see how far we can go. So $23 million budget. That's fairly modest for quite a big movie. And it made $370 million worldwide, which is massive. Like, I'm talking, it was top four highest grossing films of the year, in a year that we had at number one was Armageddon, Saving Private Ryan, Godzilla. And I guess that was like the first Godzilla movie for like at least a decade or longer. The first big budget one, at least.
It was the first Western
one. That was the first Western one. Yeah,
right. Yeah, well, there you go.
Matthew Broderick is the lead. God, that was a rough film.
Yeah. I would rewatch that for this podcast. I know it's not a comedy rewind, but God damn it, John, let's do it.
It's got Hank Azaria in it. He's a comedian, so.
You know what blows me away about everything you just said to me, Jono? Can I call you Jonathan? Can I say Jonathan?
You can call me whatever you want.
You know what blows me away, Jono?
What's that?
That Armageddon beat out Saving Private Ryan this year.
And it smashed it by like 70 million. It made...
That's incredible.
It was made all because of that Aerosmith song. That Aerosmith song just created love no matter where it was played. And it was probably used in about 2 million weddings that year alone, I'd imagine.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Possibly one of the last good Vin Diesel death scenes as well.
And Saving Private Ryan.
We'll see another one. Yeah, we'll never see another one. He'll never allow it ever again.
That was his first like major role too.
When was Fast and the Furious? Wasn't that 1999?
I think.
Oh, 2000. Yeah, okay. I was young. I don't remember things well from
that. I'd love to do an Armageddon episode. I know it's not comedy, but there's a lot of unintentional comedy there. So maybe we'll get to... There's all these action movies in the 90s that would just be like great, like Face Off.
Action Rewind.
Yeah, Action Rewind.
Action Rewind. I see a sister podcast coming on board.
Anyway, There's Something About Mary smashed it. Like, we're talking like billions of dollars now with the Avengers and that, but back then this was a lot of money and it just crushed its opposition at the time. We did a couple of weeks ago with Benny and Ali an episode on basketball. Didn't stand a chance when it was going up against There's Something About Mary.
Mm.
Rotten Tomatoes, what would be your guess for the score there?
Pretty high.
Yeah.
And I say that off the bat of knowing, reading up on this earlier, 27 in the AFI Top 100.
Oh, yeah.
So
this is a really acclaimed movie. It's in a lot of those lists of like top comedies. So it's 83%, which is not like amazing, but it's pretty good for a movie that's got a Frankenbeans in a zipper
and a hair cum scene.
Yeah,
it's pretty good for an animal human fight scene.
Yeah.
Buffer!
We'll get to that too. So the number one song when the movie released, if anyone wants to guess, it's something that's already been mentioned on a previous episode. I mean, I just said it came out at the same time as Basketball, so you might know if you've been paying attention.
Yeah, Brendan, you told me you listened to the Basketball episode as well. What was it again?
I can't remember that because I just had it. Like, I was thinking about that question today and I'm like, I was going to double down with like Savage Garden. That's where I was going because that was the year they blew up. With
In the US, it was "The Boy Is Mine" by Brandy and Monica. Ah. That's the one that we talked about on Basketball.
That's the number one song.
It was for like a couple of months. That's why it's.
Is that the boy is
that's mine? The one. It was
I'm sorry
Brandy, and I can't remember the other lady that was singing with it too, wasn't it?
Monica.
That's that song.
Yeah.
It's hard to believe that in any year that song is number one for a day, let alone 2 months.
I'm so glad you sang it though, Salim, because Ali sang it on the last episode. So I can cut together a little like supercut of you guys getting down with Brandy.
I'll do a duet with Ali. Yeah, we'll do it.
In Australia, this movie released a few months later and the number one song here was Iris by the Goo Goo Dolls.
Oh, well.
Classic. I remember that. Absolute classic.
Banger. Yeah.
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 Cool. So, what have you done for me lately? Cameron Diaz has retired. Did you know that?
I knew she took some time away, but I didn't think she made it like an official retirement.
She's fully said that she's retired. She hasn't done a film for a few years now.
Is she still with one of the Madden brothers?
Gosh, I don't know the answer to that. I didn't think she was.
Nah, she was.
Yeah, neither did I.
She was. Trust me. I know my terrible reality TV and soap melodrama. I'm well hip.
I thought that was like Sophie Monk.
She was with one of them for a bit too.
Yeah. I saw one of them in Sydney once, just outside a pub. Random as. Anyway. Ben Stiller hasn't done a movie for a couple of years. He
directs a lot lately though, right?
Yeah, he does. And he did a prison miniseries on like a prison escape based on a true story. That was the last thing he did that I heard about, and I guess he's gearing up for some big comedy. He did Zoolander 2 just a few years ago.
But didn't he do I can't remember the name of it. He did a family feel good. No, he did like a family feel good with what's his name? The Graduate. I forget his name.
Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah, he did something with Dustin Hoffman a couple of years ago.
Meet the Fockers.
No. I'm going to find it. I hope you don't mind me typing as I go.
Side note.
I don't mind you typing.
Cameron Diaz married Benji Madden in 2015. So there you go.
Well, there you go. It's such an odd pairing, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
They're such bums.
The Maddens.
Vindicated, Brendan. Yeah. Vindicated.
The Maddens pairing with anyone is kind of odd. Was one of them with Hilary Duff? Am I making that up? Probably.
You might be. She's too wholesome to be hanging out with them bloody trash burgers.
So just going back to my point really quickly, he starred in 2017 across from Dustin Hoffman, Adam Sandler, and Grace Van Patten in the Meiwitz stories.
Oh, yeah. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Was that a series, though?
Is it a series? I don't know. I haven't seen it.
I think it's on Netflix.
It's a series.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Ben Stiller. He's still a thing. I should mention that he was like this. I said this was his first leading role. It kind of set him up over the next decade. He was in a huge movie almost every year. He did Meet the Parents, Zoolander, Dodgeball, Night at the Museum, Along Came Polly, and then basically probably smaller movies than the ones I just mentioned, but pretty much hits all the way up to 2010, ending probably with Tropic Thunder, that kind of era. So
it was never going to go wrong, though. Like, his dad's Jerry Stiller. Oh. And it's like, if you ever wanted to go to Hollywood, that's the golden ticket in that your dad's already in.
It doesn't always work out. It doesn't always work out with kids of famous people. Paulie Shore didn't go too, like, you know, he had a shorter career than Ben Stiller.
Squeezing the juice.
Yeah. Jeffrey Tambor's in this movie for some reason, and he has done that Amazon series Transparent, which has been a pretty big hit with, like, winning awards and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Lee Evans, who played Tucker, he hasn't really done much. He hasn't done many movies in general. Like, he did Mouse Hunt in the 90s, which I remember loving as a kid.
Yeah. John Goodman.
No, Nathan Lane.
I hated
wasn't
that
it?
Film.
Yeah, with Nathan Lane.
It was Nathan Lane.
John Goodman was in, like, the one where they were little people. Like,
oh, okay. Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah. I've got my wires crossed there.
Yeah. So I don't know if he's doing stage and theater or something else, but I've always liked him and appreciated his style of humor, but we need to see him back in the movies. Chris Elliott, he of course plays Woogie or Dom in this film, has been really great on Creek, which is an awesome Canadian sitcom. It's on Netflix as well. And he plays the mayor of that town, and he's great. So if you haven't seen that, definitely recommend that.
Can I give you one of mine?
Yeah.
I got one here. So Keith David, who plays Mary's dad.
Yeah.
Is, and Brendan just shook his, because I feel like this may have been something Brendan wanted. Also in Armageddon.
Oh, is he in Armageddon?
He's in Armageddon as General Kimsey.
Didn't see that. I was going to say we know him from Community, at least the last couple
Hell
of
yeah.
seasons.
Oh, well, that's probably what Brendan's brandishing his fist about.
But he's also a bucket load of voiceover work. Like, he even was in Dissidia Final Fantasy for you dreamer
there.
Oh,
wow.
But, like, he's voiced in, like, Modern Warfare,
Shocking
Saints
game.
Row, Mass Effect. Done some stuff with Todd McFarlane in Spawn.
That's
he's just
awesome.
A dude.
He?
He's just got a voice that's just liquid gold.
Yeah, he's great. He's got definitely got that tone of, like, you like Dave Fennoy level kind of actor. I appreciate him a lot. He's great in this movie too. We'll get to
he's
him
great.
A bit later. Okay, here we are. What's the most 90s moment of There's Something About Mary?
I was thinking about this for a while, and I just kept coming back to the discussion around the 7 minutes abs, 7 minute abs videos. So I was just thinking in the 90s, it was like peak. Everyone was plugging a fitness. Like a fitness VHS or telemarketing.
Yeah.
I remember Aerobics Oz Style in the Morning was on television. Billy Blanks with, like, I can't remember what his thing was called, like Body Fit or something.
Bowflex?
Nah, Bowflex came out in the 2000s, I think. But
okay.
I just think of this because my mum had a few, like, of these wellness VHSs, and she had a little aerobics mat and little step in the lounge room sometimes. And that's all I keep thinking. It's just that sort of hitchhiker scene where he's talking about the 7 minute abs and obviously freaks out when they stupidly suggest what if someone comes out with 6 minutes, but that's my most 90s moment from this film.
Nice.
I think for me, mine, I struggled with it. I struggled with a lot of your questions in this film. I do have answers, but for me, there's a very particular scene that I'll zero in on, which is when Ted's getting ready for his first date with Mary after they reconnect. And Woogie says to him, "Have you been to the ATM? Did you clean your car? Have you got gas in the tank?" And that really stuck out to me as nothing I've ever considered in my life before a first date. Particularly, "Have you been to the ATM? Who gives a shit?
You don't even own a car."
Yeah. And I also don't own a car, which may be why I've never considered that one. But also, these 90s people, they've got to get with the times. Buses, trams, trains, it's all PT, baby.
That's great. No, I didn't even think of either of those. So good answers there. I've got a few contenders here. I thought the fact that there's an 80s flashback in this movie, despite being the 80s, is still a very 90s thing to do. Like, you know, I'm going to reference this a couple times here, but on Friends, they leaned into these a lot with these 80s flashbacks of getting ready for prom and that kind of thing. I don't know who did it first. Maybe one copied the other, maybe not, but I feel like that's something we saw a lot in the 90s, especially on those, even like Seinfeld doing flashbacks to 80s. Any kind of teenage flashback from the 90s is naturally going to be in that era, and it's just ripe for flashbacks with the ridiculous clothes and haircuts. There was a scene where Magda was listening to cell phone calls, you know, throughout the movie, but particularly where she's explaining how it works and like the technology of it. I love talking about technology in this question, but like you just, there's no way you could do that these days with the way that mobile phone towers and stuff work compared to how it
works. Not unless you're the American government.
Yeah, she's just sitting up there, suntanning, big ciggy in the mouth, and then the big sort of radar gun pointing out into the streets.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of thing where, like, I do remember phones interfering with speakers way more than they do now and cutting through different, like, systems. And you might be listening to the radio and it starts playing through your guitar amplifier. It was just, like, a completely different time with, I guess, the frequencies that things worked on. The other thing that I had that I wanted to throw back to Friends was the fact that Cameron Diaz is pretty much never wearing a bra in this movie. Except that when she's getting undressed for obvious reasons.
Ooh.
That's seems like a really 90s like empowerment type thing where like who cares? And I know that Jennifer Aniston did that a lot on Friends and people particularly notice when they do the rewatch now. I don't know if that's like I don't tend to notice these things, but I did notice in this movie.
Yeah,
sounds like you noticed, Joe. Yeah.
I
noticed. Sounds like you noticed.
Yeah. There's an awakening. But I think it just ties into the character as a whole. Like, she's obviously carefree, sporty.
Yeah.
Loves a beer, loves a hot dog. I can't remember the exact lines where she's talking about, like, you know, find me a guy who can play golf and hang out with me and Warren. Put 38 and drink a beer holes. And all that stuff. And it's just, she's just a tomboy and really down. Like, she's that boy next girl embodiment. Like, it's just.
The boy next door. Yeah.
Yeah.
Girl next door.
Girl next door.
But that's. Let's like just call it forward. It's sexy. It's sexy. She's sexy in this film. And that's the whole point. Not the point of the film, sorry. But that's kind of like, you know, that's the allure of who Mary is. And that's the crux of the film.
It's a movie about her. It's like she's someone that all these different guys find attractive. There's something about her that... And it's not just her physical appearance, but as Brendan mentioned, it's her whole demeanor and it's her approach to life. And I said it at the top when we were talking about Cameron Diaz. This is a great character. This is a film that, compared to the other comedies we've looked at, whether it was any of the Adam Sandler ones or Basketball, which is definitely written by a bunch of dudes, this is a really empowered woman. She's got an amazing job. She doesn't care too much about how she looks in terms of, like, okay, she's never wearing a bra. She doesn't care. She's a free spirit. She wants to be comfortable. She's like hanging out with all these disabled people in the sense that she's her brother is there and she's giving them food and she's hanging out with fishermen along the jetty and she's just a cool person and she's just there to enjoy life and I think everyone is drawn to her for that.
Yeah, she's something special.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think looking at the last film that we talked about, Jono, on this podcast, which was Happy Gilmore, and Veronica from that film. Veronica, we talked about being a very sort of 2D character and just sort of there as a generic love interest for Happy. Whereas absolutely, you know, Mary in this film is completely her own character with her own wants and needs. And you see that played out as a pivotal, you know, not, it's such an underlying thread in the story. Like the B plot almost is Mary selecting someone that she's totally comfortable with as a partner. And you see her talk often throughout the film to so many different characters about what she finds attractive and what she's looking for. And then that plays into all the gags you see throughout the film. You see Matt Dillon trying to play into everything he's eavesdropping on.
These big fake teeth he gets the big white
teeth
chompers.
The best one, yeah.
So, anyway.
No, that's great, yeah. And yeah, I just thought it was an interesting thing that I've never noticed in a movie before, that character is never wearing a bra. So I just thought I'd throw it out there. And I'm glad that it generated some actual worthwhile discussion.
I've noticed it 1,000 times. From now on, anytime I appear on this podcast, I'll let you know who is and isn't
you do that.
Wearing a bra.
Brassiere watch.
Men and women.
Watch. The other thing was meat on sticks, that conversation, which was apparently pulled from a rejected Seinfeld script. The Farrelly brothers did at least one episode of that show and they liked that Seinfeldian discussion enough to keep it for this film. And it does really feel like that a 90s style conversation that you'd hear on Seinfeld, literally. And it just reeks of that time, because Seinfeld was like, it ended in 1998 when this movie came out, and it was the biggest thing on TV.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird that you point that out, because I think that scene in particular sticks out to me as one of the moments where they actually really connect. It's kind of like where you see Matt Dillon fail, like in the so many dates that he's had and all the things that went wrong there, and then you see this really sort of just, you know, not generic, so this really messing with you, let's just talk anything right now, yeah, meat on sticks, meat in a cone moment, where they're both just having fun with it. They're not trying anything. It's just really honest. Like, that sticks out as one of the really pivotal scenes for me, where it's like, yeah, there's something legit there between these two characters, and something that you buy into as an audience.
And it's, I love the contrast between Healy and Ted, because Healy is doing everything he can to show that he ticks the boxes of what Mary's after, that he has everything in common, and then Ted comes along and he's just being himself, aside from being dishonest and stalking her and pretending to bump into her. Like, that's not honest, but in the way he presents his personality, he's not trying to be someone else.
Yeah, he's no architect building sports stadiums in Chile and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's like a good message for the kids at home. Like, you know, be yourself. If it's the right person, then it'll work out. Celine's not so sure, but hey, he's the single one of the three of us, so he's still figuring life out.
Horses for courses, mate. Horses for courses.
Okay. Maybe you should try the architect thing, see if that works for you.
It's worked pretty well.
Yeah. All right. Salim Abraham. Architect.
It's got a nice ring to it.
Yeah, I call it DreamWorks.
Here we go. This is the question that's going to be a lot of fun. Most iconic scene. There's three contenders as far as I'm concerned, but you might have a go-to. What is it?
It's the hair gel scene for me. Like, I think really? Frank and Beans started this movie off on a perfect note, and it's right up there as like a 1B. But the hair gel thing has just stood the test of time, and it obviously weaves into some discussion we're going to have a little bit later on too. But it was just something like I think that was the first time I've ever seen any form of semen referenced or used in a film, and he's just got this big oyster hanging off his ear and obviously whips it in, and then the fringe is shooting up at bloody 12 o'clock and they're out on a date and they're having a laugh and their fringe is still up. Like, it's just... it's so perfect.
I can only imagine what it would have been like in a cinema when that happened. Like, if it wasn't in the trailer, if they somehow kept that out of the trailer. I know it was in the poster for the movie, I think. But yeah, that I can just imagine the crazy, raucous laughter that would have happened.
Yeah, it's perfect. It's such a perfect piece of writing. And just the fact that they're still having the time of their lives and enjoying one another's company. And occasionally you'll see Ben Stiller's eyes sort of shoot up to the big palm tree-esque fringe she's rocking at the moment. Like, it's just
funny as well, because the framing of the shots of her, like, her head is like a few inches lower than you would naturally film her because they have to fit it in.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're going the close-ups between Ben Stiller and her, and she's like significantly lower in frame. Apparently, Fox wanted to take out that scene, which would have been a pretty big thing, but the Farrelly brothers insisted on keeping it in the script. I did read that they filmed two versions in case there was a huge reaction against it at the test screenings, and I don't know... I guess they would have had to go straight to the date. I don't know how you can film two versions of that.
Or it's just, is that hair gel? And he's like, oh yeah, it is. And he like pulls a tub out of his pocket or something, and she just does her hair and that's it. Like, they roll out.
Or it might have just been that they didn't show it. Maybe they just did it that way.
They apparently cut 6 minutes out of this to air with a PG rating in Singapore. So I wonder if this is part of that 6 minutes maybe, Jono.
Possibly. Possibly. Dream, did you have a different scene for most iconic?
I did, and look, the easy one for me is the opening, the Frank and Beans gag.
Yeah,
I think that's by far the most iconic. But I decided to go a bit different, be a bit of a contrarian. The dog fight scene with Ted
with
and
Puffer. So
these are the three scenes that I had in my mind when I said we've got a few contenders. It was Zipper, hair gel, fighting dog. So
Yeah, okay.
Let's hear your argument for the dog, because we can each take a different scene and see who's the winner at the end.
Well, I think, look, my heart's with Frank and Beans. Like, to me, that is, there's nothing like it. There's just nothing else kind of close to that that I can even think of in cinema. Just the way it just builds. It's the whole thing of you're hearing what they're saying, you're putting it together, but it's not showing you. And then only after...
Have you switched from the dog to the Frank and Beans now?
Yeah, I know, but I just, you know, I change sides. I'm a turncloak. It's only after, like, the Keith David comes in, the mum, Mark Post comes in, a cop shows up at the window randomly, and then a fireman comes through the front door and then gets someone on the radio and says, bring everyone. You can't believe it. And then it shows you what they're all looking at. It's just even now, I still can't quite work out the physiology of what's happened. Yeah. You know, like, it's just awful.
Yeah.
But on the dog fighting, I think the dog fighting thing is just hilarious, because what gets built up to that is that if Puffy barks, he's a bad guy. And so you have Matt Dillon giving the dog like Xanax or something, and then you get the Matt Dillon scene with the dog where he has to revive it, and that's a whole thing. And that's great. But then, like, they give the dog speed, but also Magda's on speed because something hits her champagne. And it's just, it's hilarious, because it transports you out of that whole f***ing context in the moment.
Lifting up the giant couch and vacuuming under it with a cigarette in.
But like even doing like the eye gouge technique that the dog puts up and squat to like block it. And he's got the dog in a headlock, and it's not at all, it doesn't make sense at all in that world, but for some reason you're there for it. And then it sets up that beautiful joke that in the next scene where, like, Puffy's completely plastered and on top of the car.
Yeah.
And stays. Yeah, it's just, I don't know, man. I couldn't stop laughing.
Ben Stiller, like, dropping elbows like he's Hulk Hogan on the dog is a pretty amazing visual. And it's almost the climax of the movie as well. Like, the way that the movie's paced is, after that, you get Woogie confronting Mary with her, like, all her shoes gathered up, and that whole confrontation, that's basically the end of the movie. So I did feel like that was kind of the climax as far as the action goes, and everything after that is more just conversations, but it is a great scene. I have to... I go with Frank and Beans just because it starts, like I said, this movie starts off as this wholesome kind of flashback, you know, the nerdy guy against all odds gets a date with his dream girl, and everything's going pretty well apart from getting, like, body slammed by Warren for touching his ears with the baseball. But yeah, what you described with just one by one person coming in there and Keith David dropping all these bombs and one-liners, it's just hilarious.
The editing of that scene, though, on you've already laid the tracks, we're just gonna walk it back. A one and a two, and next scene, we got a bleeder.
Like, that so well is, cut.
that still makes me laugh hysterically every time. Yeah.
And the thing that nails it for me is that I feel so bad for him. And, like, as guys, we can all kind of feel the pain slightly. It's like, I'm trying... Like, I'm laughing so much, but I'm also just empathizing and being like, this can ruin a person's life. And it pretty much did.
But it's everything, like, it's like from the We Got a Bleeder, they're wheeling him out. There's people everywhere. There's Warren in the back going, he was masturbating. Yeah. And then he, like, the gurney tips and he hits and he breaks his arm on the way down. Like, everything after that, it's like this guy just cannot catch a break at all.
And what makes it great is apparently the scene was based on an actual incident where the Farrelly brothers had to help a young guy who caught himself in his zipper at one of their sister's parties. That's something that I read on the internet, so it must be true.
Here's what I thought I would do is I would basically rip the zipper open. Surely that's possible. Like, surely it's not an up and down situation. You can just rip it open and save everything rather than zip it back down.
Zippers never really do what you want them to do. Like, when they're broken, they're just they're hard to work
you
with.
Try and push just the bit straight back in instead of worrying about the zip. You'd sort of just push back inwards, wouldn't you? So they'd sort of go.
There's skin in there, so
I don't know. I think there's no good way of getting out of that situation.
I think you're right, Brendan.
One of the best parts of that is when he's like, "Oh no, it's fine. I'll just I'll just cover it up and I'll go to the prom. Like no one's gonna notice, and like you're gonna be comfortable." Like he would rather do that than not go. That's just a beautiful moment. Because
Mary's his dream girl. You know, she's his everything.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. So what holds up the best?
I would have to say I really think that the humor in this. It holds up almost perfectly, and I think that there's a couple of reasons why. The first is that in every single scene almost, there's the story and there's the dialogue, but there's also something happening in the background that just catches your eye and you're just watching the whole time, and it just keeps you hooked. Like from the moment when it cuts to like Ted in the psychiatrist's office, you're getting the story that you know, this is what's happened to him. This is something that he's thinking about. But also, the psychiatrist has just slipped in from his lunch break and still has his napkin on.
Still got the bib on.
Like, every scene's got something like that in it. Like, every scene's got something else to look at or think about. And all of the, like, in-jokes are interwoven throughout the scenes. Like, whether it be Frank and Beans that Warren's calling out, you know, 10, 15 years later, as soon as he spots Ted, or if it's like Woogie seeing Ted get caught on Cops, like an episode of Cops, he's getting a blowjob from his wife, and his wife just turns up and says, "I told you he was," like, it's just so well worked in, and there's so many layers there that it catches you so well. And I think the other thing as well that really works so well in this film is that it gets away with a lot, because I think Ted and Mary are really at the core just great people. So there's that scene where Matt Dillon, his first introduction to Mary, and he's telling her what he does, and he tells her his passion is working with R words. And she's trying to tell him that she doesn't think that she's trying to tell him that she doesn't think that that word is necessarily politically correct, but she doesn't quite get it out. And he hears her and he's like, no one's going to tell me I can't hang out with a bunch of R words. Like it's, and I think it's kind of funny because that joke works perfectly today as well. Works perfectly today.
Yeah. It's interesting that it's 21 years later. People still use that word. People still have an issue with that word. And some people just still don't get that it's not right. But Mary was in 1998 saying you can't say that.
Yeah, but and that's the core of that joke. Like, that's the whole thing about that whole little bit. But I really think that for one reason or another, like just everything that makes you laugh in the film in 1998 makes you laugh right now. At least it makes me laugh. I don't know. We'll put it in front of a millennial. We'll see what happens.
No, I think you're on the money there. What about you, Brendan?
Yeah, I'm in agreement with Dream, but I'll also say just the plot, or just the main beats of the plot. Like everyone's gone through.
It's really good.
Yeah, like early adulthood. You know, your high school crush trying to do what you can to win her over, and leading up to the big day, and you know, the dream. Not so much here. Like prom isn't such a big thing for us here in Australia, but there is still those big moments of high school where you want to be there with the Mary equivalent of your school and your upbringing, and then, you know, ruining that day about the one that got away and thinking about it. And I remember when I finished school, there was a couple of years there where it's like, oh, yep, you know, this girl from my school who will remain nameless, like, yeah, what could have been? But then, like, you see him at a school reunion, you're like, oh, well, I've certainly traded up and up and up. So, but like that, and even just.
We all have our Mary.
Just like the jostling.
Oh, we all have our Mary.
The jostling for, like a Mary's attention. Like you think of when you do hit adulthood and you're 18 to your early 20s and you're all out partying together or out, and you're vying for that one Mary on the dance floor or whatever. And you've got your Tucker, you've got your Healy, you've got your Teds in every one of your groups. Like there's characters in this that I think are just very relatable to just about everybody. Like everyone knows a Healy that does bullshit and talk themselves up more and say what they have to get in, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we know a lot of them.
Yeah. We got a fair few Heelys amongst our circles. So I think it's just themes, and like romance is timeless. It can exist in this century, 200 years from now, 300 years back. You know, it's love and emotion and heart. But when you throw that humor in that Dream was talking about, it's just perfect. It's such a good movie.
Mm. Yeah, I'm glad we all came at this from a different perspective. I've got a few answers here again. One, just a really quick thing, is the casting of Brett Favre as the kind of twist that he's the Brett that got away from Mary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, being a huge NFL star at the time, he went on to play for, like, correct me if I'm wrong, Brendan, like another 12 years after this.
Yeah. He played for, like, he was drafted and played for the Packers for a long time. And then he went to the Jets for a hot minute. And then he went to and played his final few years with my Minnesota Vikings. So, played till he was 40. I think he retired at 41. So he had a hell of a career. Christ. Hell of a career.
Yeah.
Right.
And just so the joke, when they're like, you're Mary's Brett. And then he's like, what are you doing in town? He's like, here to play the Dolphins, you dumbass. And it's just like, obviously. Yeah. Football season's on.
Yeah. And there's a scene early in the movie when they're talking about Brett, and one of Mary's friends calls him the Pac-Man, like obviously playing for the Packers. So there's all these like little nods towards him being that guy. But when they reveal it to him, and I guess the fact that was relevant for so long after this movie made it hold up really well, as opposed to if they just pulled whoever was like the hot athlete at the time and then that person faded out or had some kind of, you know, career-ending injury. Good choice with Brett Favre. I wanted to talk about the character of Warren. I think that the treatment of disability in this movie is really good, especially for a comedy that's pretty goofy. And the Farrelly brothers have done something where I feel like they've emphasized or at least given representation to characters with disability in almost all their movies. But this character in particular is crucial to the plot, and it's the way that Ted interacts with him that shows Mary that he's a good person. And I think the way that Warren was portrayed, the actor that was playing him by the name of
W.L. Brown.
Yes, W.L. Brown. He really played it quite straight. He wasn't going for laughs. I think he's said this in interviews a few times, but he just wanted to play the character as they would be realistically. Because of that, it doesn't come across like they're making fun of disability. And I think that's really important.
It was a great performance. It really was. Mm. And it's still crazy to think, because he was one of the leads in Deadwood as well. He played Dan Doherty. I don't know.
He looks so different now.
But yeah, like he went on to then star in Deadwood for a few years. But yeah, he was very wholesome in his portrayal of Warren. Mm. And yeah, I think it was done with a lot of respect and a lot of care.
Yeah, and like you can even just see from if you read a few interviews about the character or about the topic that people have come up to him and said how much it meant to them. They might have like a disabled son that really connected with the character, or a brother who saw someone on the screen like themselves and just got a real kick out of it. And it's not in a way where I'm sure we could think of other movies if we thought really hard where it was more played for laughs and laughing at the character rather than them exposing other people's prejudices or assumptions.
100%. Scary Movie comes to mind with Dewey. That is certainly on the other end of the spectrum as far as respecting the that sort of side of the film.
Mm. And then the cast. The last thing I wanted to say was the cast in general. Like, this is an ensemble as much as it is Ben Stiller leading it, but everyone kind of gets a chance to have their moment on the screen. It's not just side characters. So Matt Dillon, you know, he gets a lot of time where he's the guy. Lee Evans gets his moments as well, you know, where he's dropped the keys and he's trying to pick them up. And it's and, you know, Matt Dillon fighting the dog, or reviving the dog, I should say. Like, everyone kind of gets their turn to have the spotlight. And I like that about this movie. It's not like an Adam Sandler movie or even a Jim Carrey movie where it's mostly centered around this star and then everything else is secondary. So I think those three things, and the fact that everyone that was in this movie is still working today and still quite funny and has gone on to do some great stuff, that really holds up well for me. But if we've covered that off, what holds up the worst? And I know you guys might have some trouble with this one because we're all such fans of the movie.
It's tough. Like, this is really tough.
You might have to get petty.
It absolutely need to get petty. Like, for me, it's funny that you called it out as one of the strengths. I think the NFL Brett Favre thing probably holds up the worst for me, not being an NFL guy, not being American, knowing nothing about this person, and also it being 15 years on from when this film's come out, there or more, almost no 21 years on from when the failed math. Like, that to me doesn't hold up so well, and I feel like the longer you go, that age is probably the poorest out of everything. That's true. Like, you're really relying on that it is a domestic audience who knows who this person is at that point in time. So I don't think that holds up well at all. So disagree.
Well, let's say the thing with that is if you're gonna go with an NFL player, I think they picked the right one because of his career after the film, as far as relevance. Unless it was like Shaq, like, who else is it going to be that gets that twist where...
But you're always going in on a sports star at the moment. So that will always age. It doesn't matter who it is. Like, it could be LeBron James today, and in 30, 40 years, 50 years, like... Anyway, who's what? Anyway, it doesn't
people
matter.
People still
being
do
petty.
That.
We're being petty here.
People don't make movies thinking about how it's going to be received in 21 years. That's the other thing.
No. They're thinking about how's it going to do this year.
Yeah.
Matt Dillon's mustache is the only thing I could come up with.
I had that. That was my first thing. As soon as he came on the screen, I wrote it down. Matt Dillon's mo. It's terrible. And I don't know, like, if it's terrible at the time. Like, was it meant to be bad? Because he's clearly a certain type of character, and he's wearing the Hawaiian shirts, and I don't know. I don't know if it was cool at the time.
With a blazer.
I don't remember. Like, I know there was a bit of a Hawaiian shirt fad at the tail, like, in the 90s, but I can't remember if it was sort of the mid or late. And it's sort of come full circle because that look he's got going holds up very well in today's hipster circles. Like, you see all the Hawaiian attire in every shop front now, and the little, like, hats that he's wearing, and the mustache. And I'm with you guys, like... Pat Healy's fashion sense and facial hair, and then obviously his crazy teeth he gets done to woo Mary a little bit more. That was my sort of biggest black mark as far as things that would hold up the worst today. But yeah, walking down King Street in Newtown, you'd probably see two dozen Pat Healy's in the space of 500 meters. So I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
I think they'd have the twirly moustache instead of like the Frenchman, like whatever you call that one he had.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, a little bit of sort of mo wax just to flick the ends up. Yeah.
The other thing that I had was the tan on Magda. Like, I know it's going for a certain character look, but it actually just looks like they've caked on makeup rather than they've got the kind of natural over tan, if that's what you'd call it.
But it's great. It's so on brand for her character.
It's hilarious. Yeah. Did you know that actress that played her was in Dumb and Dumber, Brendan?
Really?
Mrs. Noogie Burger.
Oh, and then it's Noogamaborn. Yeah, the with the dogs at the start. Yeah. And it's isn't it also Happy Gilmore's Nana? Isn't that the same lady?
I don't know.
No,
it's not.
It's not.
Nah.
Different actress.
She's a bit younger. She's playing older in this movie. But she was in all of the Farrelly Brothers, like the first three movies. I think she was in Kingpin too. So just a little bit of trivia there. Did you have anything else to add for holding up badly, Brendan?
Nah, I think we're sort of just clutching at straws already because it is.
Yeah, that's fine.
It's just a great film.
I forgot to mention it before when I was talking about the mustache on Matt Dillon, but his friend Jeffrey Tambor's character,
Sully, yeah,
he doesn't have much to do. It's almost like a non sequitur having him in this movie because they ended up cutting a lot of his scenes. There was like a whole subplot with him that got scrapped. So it did feel like it dragged a little bit when they're arriving at his apartment and introducing him and he's offering him the beer and that whole thing. So yeah, I personally felt like if they needed to trim something, that could have come out of it. Brendan, I know you love this movie, but does that make sense to you?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. That makes sense, especially like knowing that it was sort of cut the way it was and it did feel a little bit disjointed and unnecessary. So yeah, I could have done without more Sully in my life.
Yeah, the kind of only payoff for him being introduced at all, because they really go into a long way to introduce him. He picks him up at the airport or whatever it is, and he's like driving him, and they're having these conversations in the car. The payoff is really when they're doing that fake phone call back and forth and reading off the script.
Oh yeah, about that's how a great he's scene. Yeah, helping all the orphans and everything like yeah, that. Yeah,
and the dog, like the Great Dane comes along and like takes away his script, and he has to just like wing it. That's pretty funny. And then of course the like has the snake eaten the dog? No, he's actually eaten Sully. Yeah. Is that what we're supposed to take from that? That's a joke that it's a little out of place because it's so dark in a movie that's not really going for that style of humor.
Yeah, yeah, it was sort of, it didn't feel true to the rest of the soul of the film, that's for sure. Like they obviously show a bit of violence and whatnot, but yeah, they don't never really. Oh, well, I guess you think about the hitchhiker had a dead body in that sleeping bag.
Yeah, but this is like. Healy basically reacts to his friend dying like, oh, like, bummer. And that's pretty much all we get. And then it's like, that's the punchline, is that he realizes it's his friend inside the snake.
Yeah.
And then it's the end of the scene.
Yeah, but I guess Healy's very much, he's number one, two, and three. It's all about Healy first. Yeah. And Sully was probably just another piece of this chess game he's playing to try and woo Mary.
Yeah.
There's a great, like, the scene where you meet Sully for the first time too, where he drives up to pick up Healy, and Healy goes to pat the dog, and he's like, ooh, does it bite? So he's like, a little bit, get in. Yeah. Like, that always gets me. That every time I say it, it always gets a giggle out of me.
Yeah. We'll move on ahead. Is there anyone, do you think, that would be offended by this film's presence if it was to release now?
Depends on how sensitive or precious we want to interpret the potential people that could be offended. Obviously, the treatment of Puffy could get sort of some animal activists up in arms. For one, they drugged the dog. They physically beat the dog. They electrocuted the dog. The dog caught on fire. The dog's in a full body cast. So old Puffy got pretty smacked about. Maybe sort of the gay community could get a little bit offended with the whole pulling up at the rest stop there, and then just, you know, he was literally tripping over, you know, gay men mid-coitus and whatever else, and they all just scatter. Like, I don't know, maybe that's a little bit distasteful. And
they are the bathhouses of the 90s.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
Is the implication in that movie that it was illegal to participate in gay acts back then?
No. I think it's more that it's probably illegal to f people in public.
Yeah. That was my understanding and interpretation of it. Yeah. That it was just, yeah, public nuisance and public nudity. And
I know it was Florida, and there's like some states that have been late. Even in Australia, like Tasmania, were quite late to legalize such things.
If that was like, if this movie was based, like that scene was based in probably Alabama or something, the cops would have just shot them all, I'd assume. So, yeah, lucky they picked Florida.
Yeah. I think for me, comparing this to something like Animal House, where there's very clear things there that would not at all fly today in this current climate, there's really nothing in this film that stands out as being offensive. There are things you could nitpick, and I think particularly in this day and age, there's always going to be someone offended by something.
Mm.
It doesn't matter how mundane it is. But there's nothing that really sticks out to me as being grossly offensive or hasn't aged well. I think it's done well. It's done really well.
Compared to some other films we've looked at, there was no like that would definitely cause a think piece if it came out today. I think that they skated along fairly well. I love mentioning Peter because they're offended by everything. But the what's the dog's name again?
Puffy. Thank you, Brendan.
There'd definitely be issues with the treatment of Puffy, but it's clearly a fake dog.
It's so good though, so good.
Yeah. So there's something about Mary pass the internet relevancy test. I haven't come across it a lot in GIFs and memes that I can think of, and even doing a bit of a search before we started recording, there's not really anything that leaps out as iconic reactions, which is surprising because there's so much happening in this movie.
Yeah, I'm with you. Like there is some very famous scenes, like the Frankenbeans and things like that, but you don't really see that translated into social media culture where, yeah, you're seeing like the Frankenbean zip sort of Ben Stiller face look, or even little things, you know, when they're fishing on the wharf and he cops that big hook in the mouth from Warren and stuff like that. Like, you never see any of that getting used as far as reactions and things go on any sort of social platform, which is sad because there's some great moments and some great shots that have a lot of laughs and great memories attached to it, but it's just over there in the corner, really, isn't it?
It really is. And it's funny. It is kind of sad. And I think it's probably more, it's a victim of the time it came out in, and that the internet wasn't as prevalent back then, because
I don't know,
there's so much physical humor in this that lends itself to memes and lends itself to GIFs that you can see it becoming really, you know, just really meme-worthy. But I think that just because it's maybe not,
I don't know if that's the reason, Dream, because there's so many movies we've done, like Billy Madison or Dumb and Dumber, where there's tons and they just proliferate. Yeah, like I feel like it's... I don't know. It could almost be like a study of what makes something memeable or GIF-worthy, because some things just seem to catch on and others don't.
I can think of like 5 great memes right now that I can't say here because the content is probably more explicit in my head than what you'll allow me to say here, Johnny. But I can I can really meme this movie. Maybe that could be a little fun piece to go to. I'll drop up a couple of memes and and throw them on AP.net.
You can use those.
We can get the people to vote.
We can get you on back on Twitter, Dream, to promote this episode with some of those
memes. I don't know what that is. Maybe that's why I haven't seen the memes.
That's it. You're out of touch, mate.
Yeah.
But even if I do a search for like throw dog, it doesn't come up with anything from that fight scene or fight dog even. It just doesn't come up.
Okay.
It's not in the library.
I love the phrase throw dog.
Throw dog.
What did come up? That's what I want to see.
Other dogs?
Benji and Air Bud and all these other bloody famous film dogs. Yeah. Taken over the GIF world.
Hopefully.
I'm going to do a live search right here now. If I type in hair gel, surely something comes up.
No. Yeah. You've got to type in Mary hair scene.
No, I've got, is that hair gel? And then I've got just a shot of Mary with the hair sticking up.
Yeah. There you go. So, all right, that's good.
It's got something. But I would say it does not pass the internet relevancy test. No. Sorry. Okay, how would smartphones and social media change this movie?
I
think there's an obvious first answer, which is that Ted would have Facebook stalked Mary for sure.
He
wouldn't need to hire a PI. We're all our own PIs now.
That, and also then like Tucker and Healy and all their shtick would have been found out really early in the piece. Like, instead of Tucker, who was, you know, Norm the pizza delivery boy, falls in love with the dropping off a pie one night and hatches this scheme, and then obviously Healy does the same. I think, you know, Mary
breaks
when she meets these people would just jump on, as you said, Facebook or just Google that name and see that it's all a sham.
I think yes and no. I still think there's a place for this, and maybe this sort of bleeds into the make it in 2019 question as well. But she changed her name. You know what I mean? This is a person who didn't want to be found. And so that still kind of is there for now. Like, you can still go. Like, totally agree that in 2019, you don't need a PI to go and find people. But like, there are people that I... have tried stalking in the past, you know, potential prey that just I cannot find, no matter what, on any of the social media, which is partly why I'm not on there anymore.
But you know what? Really, when you have needed to find people, sometimes you come to Brendan White Healy over here,
and
I'm usually like 9 out of 10, I'll find who you're looking for.
Brendan White Healy, who are, yeah, more like 99 out of 100. You're actually incredible on there. I think you can still do the film, and I think that the social media thing changes it, but probably not by that much if you really think about it.
I think, though, they lost touch after high school. After the incident, they somehow never reconnected. They completely lost touch. I think with Facebook and stuff now, you would have a bit more of a
runway.
You'd keep in touch a bit more. Like, if you want to, like, I'm sure anyone that you went to high school with, Dream, if you were friends with them at the time and you wanted to, like, maybe if they were your Mary, you've probably been keeping tabs on it.
Oh, yeah. No, I've burned all my Mary bridges, mate. Don't worry.
Even just owning cell phones, you know, like, if they would have obviously exchanged numbers at school, and if she was to move away, he could have texted her and they could have kept chatting, even if it was set in that 90s period as opposed to the 2000s when social media wasn't as big as what it is today.
The other difference would be when, how do I put this? When Ted's cleaning the pipes, he wouldn't be reading Target catalogs or whatever. Yeah. He'd have his mobile phone out.
Yeah. That's fantastic. You know,
maybe he's phoned. I don't know. You're bang on, though. You're absolutely right.
Maybe he's just a wholesome guy. You know, salt of the earth filler. He doesn't want to get any bloatware on his cell phone searching Pornhub or something. So he just grabs the Target catalog or the Macy's catalog or whatever it might be. Who knows?
Yeah. Cool. All right. Could we make this film in 2019? What would the 2019 version be? I think you absolutely could. I think it would still hold up, still be relevant. I think we need movies like this. I think that it's something that would be really welcome around now.
I'm with you too, and you could almost just reshoot this thing line for line and it'd still stack up in today's society.
Yeah.
Like
with the same cast.
Oh, yeah. Imagine like, Ben Stiller going back to 16 years old in a flashback now.
It's like, it's a story that isn't necessarily, like, you could do this with characters in their 40s, you know, who is like, there's nothing that centers it around the age. And that's, I think that's actually something really special about this film, that you could do it at any point in someone's life where they're just trying to reconnect with something they've lost or something that they never got to see fulfilled. Yeah. It's beautiful.
Having said the whole thing about, like, Facebook and everything, I've got a couple friends from uni who've, like, whether it was a couple of years after uni or more recently, like, gone off the grid, basically, like, got off social media, and because they've moved away, like, no one really knows what they're doing. And I guess it is still possible to just disappear. If you cut off ties to social media, it's amazing how quickly that can happen. So, yeah, I think it would still work. I think it could still happen. Like, a plot like this wouldn't need many changes to function in 2019. I guess... finding a way to modernize it, it'd be interesting with a younger cast.
Did you guys have like a modern day cast in mind?
Oh,
I didn't go that really far, but I think it would be like maybe an Emma Stone type character as Cameron Diaz. She's like the girl that everybody likes.
Is
Margot Robbie? You might say.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Margot Robbie's kind of a bit more the flavor at the moment.
Would like Jonah Hill be Woogie, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
I still or love Healy. That part where he's like, "You're Woogie," and he's like, "Yeah, Steve Woganowski, duh." Like
Don Woganowski, Don Woganowski. Yeah.
It's funny watching it when you know the plot and they're dropping all these hints along the way about like him being in on it. Like he knew the whole Frank and Bean story. He's like, "Oh yeah, I was only four towns over."
Yeah, that's so good.
Who would be the modern Matt Dillon?
I had Chris Pratt, and I don't feel great about that. But
he's too handsome.
I couldn't think of anyone.
Matt Dillon's
I couldn't think of anyone
creepy.
Sort of seedy enough.
Give me like Adam Driver with a big seedy mustache.
Oh yeah, yes.
Yeah, that would work.
He could definitely rock the mustache quite well.
Mm.
That's a good one. Matt Dillon's a funny guy because he was obviously a huge star at the time, but because I watched Entourage, I became so used to Kevin Dillon that like Matt Dillon looked like the inferior brother to me. Useless trivia. The studio was initially reluctant to allow Ben Stiller to star in this film, so they were talking about getting an unknown actor by the name of Owen Wilson instead. So the studio was even more reluctant to let Owen Wilson star in the movie, so they let the Farrellys cast Ben Stiller.
It wouldn't have been the same. Like, I love Owen Wilson. I like Luke Wilson more than Owen Wilson, truth be told, though. But it wouldn't have been the same. Ben Stiller's just... he's great in this role.
This is a Ben Stiller character. Like, I don't know if it's because he made it his own and brought his humor to it, but it just feels like him, yeah.
His cry, like, at the very end of the movie where he's bawling his eyes out after he walks away and he's just this snotty mess, and then she runs up and obviously she swerves him the first time, and he, you know, grabs his keys and he's like, oh, okay, and starts bawling again, snot flying out, and keeps walking. Oh, it gets me. It gets me every time.
Yeah, he's good. It's funny, though, because Stiller and Owen Wilson were, like, already friends, I think. Owen Wilson was in Cable Guy, which Ben Stiller wrote and directed, and then obviously went on to do Zoolander and all these other films together. Chris Farley was considered for the role of Warren, which would have been a very different portrayal. We talked before about how it was played so, you know, realistic and almost as a dramatic role, like a Forrest Gump style approach, like a Tom Hanks approach by W. Earl Brown. But Chris Farley, I think, would have been hilarious, but I don't know if he would have brought the dignity to the role that it ended up having.
Yeah, no way. No way.
Yeah. And he ended up dying during the filming, so it would have probably marred the production quite a bit to have him involved. Rest in peace. We're going to get to Tommy Boy eventually. I've never seen Tommy Boy, so I'm looking forward to doing that one.
It's a great film.
I've never seen Tommy Boy.
Yeah, okay. The Steve Buscemi Sparkplug Award. We have a few nominees here. Keith David was the first one I wanted to shout out. I want to mention Sarah Silverman for being in this movie, but she doesn't really do much.
Yeah, Mary's judgmental friend.
Yeah, this just like the friend, which was her role in Hollywood for a long time before she kind of got massive. Jeffrey Tambor as Sully. He's got some good parts. We talked about reading the script on the couch, and his coked up phone call was quite funny too. Harlan Williams, who I think we gave this award to in Dumb and Dumber, didn't we?
Yeah, we did, when he was the highway cop.
Yeah, he's great as the, I think, uncredited role here.
Yeah, he is.
The hitchhiker.
Yeah, uncredited.
Seven chipmunks twirling on a branch in lots of sunflowers on my uncle's ranch.
And then he's like, step into my office. Why? Because you're fired.
Yeah. Apparently he was like impossible to direct. Like whatever they told him, he just did his own thing.
Yeah, you could see he's a unique dude. Like he walks to the beat of his own drum, that's for sure.
Definitely. Yeah. But if you guys don't object, I think Keith David deserves this award because
at the start of that movie,
like a lot of the humor is just coming from him drilling Ted's character and just stirring him up and the one-liners that he's dropping in the Frankenbean scene.
I'll double down on that too. And you know, they even have a reference to Sparkplug in this film as well. You know, when
yeah, no, it wasn't Sparkplug.
No,
it was Butt Plug.
It was a Butt Plug, yeah, because it's like, yeah. I think I still want to look her up. He's like, who, Roller Pig?
Because she was nuts. Heinous.
You said she was a real Sparkplug. No, I said Butt Plug. She's heinous.
Yeah.
Yeah, that got me, that line. I should have cottoned on a bit quicker that Healy was a bit sketchy.
It's just...
All right. So, I mean, all in all, is this still a good movie? I think obviously the answer is yes.
Resounding yes.
Yes. Universally heard across the nation, yes.
Any parting words? I think we've sung the praises probably enough, but any last words?
Anyone that hasn't watched this movie, for one, I guess, I don't know why you're listening to this recap, but... Go watch it again if you haven't watched it in quite some time, because it is truly one of the best comedies of the 90s and one of the better comedies that I've seen in my life. Like it is up there as one of my favorite comedic films from any era.
Yeah, no, I think that again, just on the AFI Top 100 thing, to feature on that list as a comedy in such a like a drama heavy list. Like it's hard for comedies to get recognized against films of other genres as being equal or great. And so to see this on that list is like that speaks volumes. So if nothing we've said is enough to persuade you to watch it, if you haven't already seen it, that alone should persuade you to go and watch it. It's brilliant.
Yeah. You make a good point there, Dream. I think for a comedy to get respect as a film, like not a movie or a popcorn flick, but as a film, like it's really done well and it's held up in high esteem. It's probably along those lines of like the Big Lebowski in the 90s, where it's like,
yeah,
people, like critics loved it. Obviously, a lot more people went to see this than the Big Lebowski, which became a cult classic. But this is something that it's on that line of like it's a gross out movie for teenagers, but then it's also just so clever and just there's visual gags and there's slapstick, but then there's just running jokes through the movie and background gags, like you mentioned before, Dream. There's just so much in it for people to enjoy. And you guys watched it as kids and loved it, as you said. Your parents watched it as adults and loved it as well, which says a lot, I think. And we're watching it now as grown-ups and we still love it.
It probably says more about our parents than anything else, but yeah, it says a lot.
I just wanted to shout out Jonathan Richman as well. Obviously, the sort of guy doing the narration and the singing throughout the whole movie. I love those little touches in that film, and obviously gets shot at the very end, spoilers, but fantastic.
Yeah, those interstitials really give the movie like a unique kind of flavor and style that it kind of puts you in that surreal where anything can happen. And it's not like they go too far with that, but there is some, like when he's doing the Three Stooges gag with the dog fight and some of that stuff, like it makes it feel less glaring that they go all the way out there with something when you've got these dudes playing like live music narrating the film. Alright, well, thanks dudes. We've got iTunes reviews, obviously, listeners. If you're out there, you want to help the show, you can do so with your iTunes ratings and reviews. I want to thank our Patreon producers out there as well who make this show happen. We very much love your support and just wouldn't be able to do this without you guys. It gives us the energy, keeps the emotional lights on, as Brendan loves to say.
You are the Frank to our beans, Patreon producers. The Frank to our beans.
Yeah, one without the other is just sad.
On an unrelated note, I watched a documentary about the guy with the world's largest scrotum last night, and it was 100 pounds. 100 pounds scrotum.
Moving forward.
That's pretty big. That sounds like another Farrelly Brothers movie that's yet to be filmed. But anyway, listeners out there, you can give us your questions, comments, and corrections if you want to weigh in. You can do that by hitting us up on the social medias. I'm at Johnny himself. Brendan, where can we find you?
I am at Brendan8bit.
And Salim, do you want to be found?
Yeah, if you're trying, you can find me at SalimTD.
Yeah, he may respond. He may hit you with a "there's something about Mary" meme. I don't know. He says that they're out there. There's only one way that he can prove it. Join us on the next episode of Comedy Rewind. We're going to be looking at Office Space. That's going to be me and Dagan Moriarty from Knockback fame.
I hope there is a lot of stapler discussion in
Oh,
film.
Yeah.
A lot of stapler discussion.
Very keen to get into that Mike Judge movie. Gotta love him. As always, dear listeners, thank you for joining us on Comedy Rewind. Be kind.